Good afternoon. I'm Gabriel Kamenzouli, and will be conducting today's program, Is Debate Bill. This is a weekly discussion of current affairs in its second series. The program is run by the Department of International Relations in the Faculty of Arts at the University of Malta, as part of the course assessment for research methods. Today's students, who are Samuel Shikluna and Yulia Stasiev, an international student from Ukraine, we'll be discussing nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. After the break, we will have a short intervention by Dr. Cleda Moulay, a university lecturer of international relations and an expert in conflicts and warfare. Before starting today's debate, Dr. Carmen Samoud will give us an introduction on nuclear proliferation in the Middle East.
Thank you, Gabriel. On the world stage, the official nuclear actors are five: America, Russia, Britain, France and China, the holders of permanent seats in the United Nations Security Council. All five had nuclear weapons before 1970, the year that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty came into force. These five nuclear nations, France and China joined in 1992, promised to move towards nuclear disarmament. Yet China is still adding its nuclear base. With the end of the Cold War, the others have been reducing but modernizing their weapons. The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is also weakened by non-signatory nations that include Israel, India and Pakistan, who also have nuclear weapons. Moreover, while the Non-Proliferation Treaty prevents nations from developing weapons of mass destruction and from supplying them to non-nuclear states, it does not stop them from conducting research on nuclear energy. International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors have a difficult job to stop countries from covering up their nuclear weapon capabilities in the guise of energy research. So where does the Middle East stand in this scenario? During the Cold War era, countries like Egypt were at the forefront of the non-aligned movement. As a leading voice in the Arab world, Egypt then advocated a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East. Most Middle Eastern countries were in agreement, directing their attention to Israel, that had already nuclear capabilities. In December 1974, Egypt moved a resolution in the United Nations General Assembly, inviting all nations in the Middle East to reciprocally agree not to produce and acquire nuclear weapons. That resolution was co-sponsored by Iran, then under the US-backed Shah. Yet, in the post-Cold War, the Arab world's position on nuclear development changed. Middle Eastern nations, including Iran and even Egypt, now have open ambitions to acquire nuclear capabilities that match those of the nuclear nations. These ambitions are the reason beneath the Gulf crisis. The weapons of mass destruction were the main pretext behind the USA and British intervention against Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Now, Iran's fiddling with nuclear energy and its insistence to enrich uranium in defiance to the UN Security Council is adding fuel to the fire. Iran is deemed to be close to nuclear weapon development, which may take between 3 to 10 years to materialize. The Iranian ambition to acquire nuclear weapons is driven by fear of other regional nuclear players, namely its neighbor Pakistan and antagonistic Israel. However, Iran justifies its nuclear program by saying it is merely seeking to advance its fuel-making capabilities. This is raising the alert for Israel. For the first time since its independence, Israel is close to facing an existential threat, warned the Israeli Internal Security Minister, Avi Dikter. Israel fears that with Iran as a nuclear nation, it could become the leader of a pan-Islamic regime in the region. In the midst of the recent debates over Iran, Israeli leaders came close to acknowledge a widely known secret: the existence of the Israeli nuclear arsenal. Israel is not a signatory of the United Nations Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and so technically it does not have to abide to international conventions. Up to now, it has neither denied nor admitted nuclear weapons. Israelis call this nuclear ambiguity. Because of this ambiguity, it is perceived as a nuclear power, but at the same time, Israel avoids retribution by the international community. Yet, it is widely believed by arms control experts that Israel began its nuclear program in the mid-1950s. The Federation of American Scientists says that it has around 200 nuclear warheads, which would make Israel the sixth largest nuclear power in the world. These could be fired by air, sea, or by ground, and they could hit countries like Libya, Iran, or even Russia. The existence of the Dimona nuclear complex in the Negev Desert was confirmed by the whistleblower Mordecai Vanunu. In 1986, Vanunu, a nuclear technician who worked at Dimona, leaked details of the program to the British press. For his actions, he was sentenced for treason and espionage and spent 18 years behind bars in Israel, 11 of which in solitary confinement. The American U.S. Army Strategic Studies Institute recently pointed out that if Iran's nuclear program is unchecked, this could encourage Tehran's Arab neighbors and Turkey either to seek nuclear capabilities of their own or to import nuclear technologies. In fact, the specter of the nuclear arms race in the Middle East has already been raised, as a number of Arab countries announced they are entering the nuclear fray. Besides Egypt, other nations from Morocco to Algeria, Tunisia, the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia announced they are embarking on programs to master atomic technology. They want to build nuclear energy programs primarily for desalination purposes, but it is feared that the real intention is to acquire the technology that could be used for the first Arab atomic bomb. While the media are busy discussing the terrorist threat, the prospect of a nuclear arms race in the Middle East is real indeed. As the new UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon endeavors to reform the United Nations to make it more effective, words such as non-proliferation and nuclear disarmament are bound to re-enter the international agenda. In this sphere, the challenges faced by the UN are now maybe even more complex than they were during the Cold War period.
Thanks, Dr. Samud. After the introduction, Bruno Parsons, an international relations student from Brazil, will read some quotes from newspapers and articles that concern today's debate.
The following two quotes are by Robert Einhorn, a senior advisor at the International Security Program. The first one, he states, still I think it may be possible over time to convince Iranian leaders that nuclear weapons are simply not in Iran's national interest. The next quote by him, he states that one thing Israel should do is state that in the context of a comprehensive and durable peace in the Middle East, it is prepared to give up its nuclear option as long as others in the region, including Iran, do the same. The next quote is by Gidi Amini for the Center of Nonproliferation Studies. Having incomplete signing and ratification records and mixed success in adherence, the key Middle East powers' participation in nonproliferation regimes is a point of controversy within the region and a source of frustration for the international community.
Since the end of the Cold War, Middle Eastern states have endeavored to develop their own nuclear capabilities. Yulia Stasev, how does the alleged arms control proliferation in the Middle East compare with the Cold War arms race?
Well, I think that there is a lot of resemblance between the Cold War and the Middle East today. In both cases, we can see the increase in arms race in the region. In the times of Cold War, two superpowers tried to compete with each other on the basis of warfare technology. Now, in the Middle East, we see that after Iran has declared its determination to develop nuclear technologies, a number of states, such as Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and even United Arab Emirates, consider going nuclear as well. The number of capabilities afford more prestige and strength to the countries, but in the Middle East, nuclear power also implies better national security and safety, as each country is surrounded by rivalry and antagonistic neighbors. Nevertheless, in my opinion, states should avoid acting emotionally and should seek alternative ways to enhance their security and build their prestige. I believe that diplomacy and negotiations should be the weapon, but not bombs and revenge. As Gandhi said once, an eye for an eye makes all world go blind.
Samuel, what are your comments? In what ways there is a comparison? To start with, it is important to remember that US-Soviet tensions were stabilized under very different conditions. The two superpowers lacked national and religious-based territorial disputes and never engaged in direct combat against each other. But a look at the history of the region shows us that this is most certainly not the case in the Middle East. Even in the chilliest days of the Cold War, the superpowers maintained sufficient diplomatic relations while prudently avoiding direct military clashes. Both sought stability, and the common interest of avoiding accidental war was always discussed and adhered to. By the 70s, both sides were able to cooperate in the Conference for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Arms control requires the realization of common dangers between rivals. This is the fear of a first strike scenario and a second strike capability, but most of all it included the common interest of avoiding them. The only security experiment in the Middle East was the Arms Control and Regional Security Working Group centered on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Of course, its creation has shown that such a thing is possible. As a sponsor, the US logically based it on experience from the bipolar context. But despite focusing on informal confidence-building measures, the project unfortunately collapsed by 1995. From the look of things today, there is what is called a lukewarm arms race. Israel's nuclear capabilities are being counterbalanced by Iran's nuclear development, which in turn is being balanced by how other regional players plan to arm themselves. An article by the UK's Guardian blamed the West's reinterpretation of the 1967 Non-Proliferation Treaty, legitimizing possession by existing nuclear states while using it to confront states accused of proliferation. As the article says, the attitude of do what we say, not as we do, leads resentful countries to proliferate. An entire list of countries have ratified the treaty. Not only has it not stopped them from trying to create a nuclear potential, but it has not even slowed the rate of proliferation. Another Washington Times article grimly explains how a Middle East with 4, 5, or even 6 nuclear weapon states will be the reality of the early 21st century. As a result, international observers agree on how the Non-Proliferation Treaty has been generally fruitless in the region. Taking nothing else into account, I must say that despite acknowledging the existence of an arms race in the region, I am not in any way justifying the position of any state involved, be it Western, Arab, or non-Arab. After all, a nuclear arms race, wherever it occurs, is always a menace to humankind worldwide. You both said that nuclear development should be deterred as much as possible. Samuel, is today's situation in the Middle East less explosive than it was in the past?
First of all, it is true that the Middle East has come a long way from post-colonial military dictatorships, yet there is an imminent danger the situation will become literally explosive. Clearly, the international community has failed to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Furthermore, the region has not recovered from colonial or Cold War-style external influence. Even internally, Arab states have not settled into the false dead straight boundaries that colonial officers drew at a ruler more than half a century ago. Analysts have described the Middle East as being in its Westphalian stage compared to European history. So if this realist assumption is credible, then many more wars are to be fought before the region enjoys stability. After all, can we deny that Europe only settled down after many traumatic wars? Expecting the same thing in the Middle East is a terrifying contemplation for the whole world. On top of this, nuclear weaponry is constantly advancing. Arms controls are pointless if participants deny each other's legitimacy. Even the first declaration, 1950, by the US, France and Britain to limit arms sales in the region was packed with loopholes of different interpretations. Contrasting Western interests sealed its failure. The same happened with other arms control efforts due to the bipolar context, resulting in the corruption of each initiative.
Yulia, what is your opinion on today's situation in the Middle East?
Well, I think the situation today in the Gulf is not less explosive than it used to be in the previous years. After Iranian president's claim to wipe Israel off the map, I believe that we should not have any doubts left about the seriousness of the situation in the region. The thing is that violence in one part of the world today can affect all regions, because the interconnections between countries today are closer and tighter than they were in the past. From my point of view, if the international community does not wish to see more violence in the region, it should make an effort to persuade the Middle Eastern countries to surrender their nuclear ambitions and provide them with other opportunities for peace. From the liberal point of view, in international relations theory, I think the West should offer the opportunities for trade, economic cooperations, and sharing of resources. Thus, the interdependence in the tribal region will increase. As a result, we have higher chances to see peace without nuclear danger in the Gulf.
The discussion will continue with a phone out to Dr. Claire de Moulay just after a short break. Welcome back to the second part of the program. Today we are discussing nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. We have Dr. Claire de Moulay, who will give us her comments. So, Dr. Moulay, how would you assess the development of nuclear weapons with regards to security in the Middle East?
Of course, at the moment, nuclear weapons are discussed with particular reference to the Middle East, but it will be useful to consider the question in a broader context, in order to understand what has changed in the debate and to what extent. We have been living with nuclear weapons for more than half a century. Indeed, some say that such weapons help to keep the Cold War cold. However, present concerns about nuclear weapons suggest that many of us may not necessarily agree. So, what has changed? What has changed is the strategic context. As one is likely to find in most textbooks, during the Cold War there was a single threat providing policy and strategic inspiration for nuclear weapons. Today, the threat is a diffuse set of possibilities. The superpowers were not motivated to compete for territory, and they learned how to coexist with shared nuclear danger. That was the nuclear era of the Cold War, or as is also called, the First Nuclear Age. But as I mentioned, so sharply has the strategic context changed since the end of the Cold War that it is said that we are now in a second nuclear age. If in the first nuclear age, nuclear weapons were sought by the bigger powers, in the second nuclear age of the 21st century, nuclear weapons are sought by the weaker states like Iran and North Korea. The answer to the question, why do states seek nuclear weapons, has not necessarily changed, because they want to enhance their security, want to attend the interests of their domestic constituencies, and want to gain prestige. One of the motives most amenable to change, paradoxically, is the need for security. The reason for this is that security is provided by a variety of means, and acquisition of nuclear weapons might not be the best way of achieving security. So state leaders, in principle, should be open to persuasion that there are other alternative ways to augment security rather than through nuclear weapons. The recent breakthrough with North Korea seems to fall in this latter category. When a state wants to have nuclear weapons to offset domestic discontent or to enhance its prestige, there is little that outsiders can do to change that policy. This seems to me to be the problem the international community is facing with Iran. The problem with nuclear weapons is that it matters who has them. It does not matter that the United States, Britain, and France has them. But it does matter if Iran has them. Iran is not a trusted member in the International Society of States. Iran uses inflammatory and threatening rhetoric against Israel. Iran has hegemonic ambitions in the Gulf region, and it has a record of supporting Shia terrorist militias in Iraq. Iran cannot be trusted not only by the West, but also by its neighbors. And there is genuine concern that Iran might pass on nuclear expertise and technologies to violent non-state actors. There is also genuine concern that a nuclear Iran will induce other Middle Eastern states to acquire nuclear weapons. So, the danger of proliferation is indeed real. The Middle East has been for long home of ongoing violent conflict, and the addition of nuclear weapons is not likely at all to contribute to mitigate existing animosities.
Thanks, Dr. Clay Demolay, for your comments. During the last few years, Iraq has been at the center stage with regards to politics in the Middle East and world affairs. Yulia, in which ways does instability in Iraq impinge on other regional players?
As I mentioned earlier, the turbulence in one region can easily affect the situation in other parts of the world. Moreover, it will leave an impact on regional players and the immediate neighbors of the area hit by the conflict. So, while Iraq is subject to U.S. dominance, if its immediate neighbor Iran develops nuclear technologies, it will undoubtedly challenge U.S. interests. In short, I think that today, if nuclear development will take place in Iran, there will be repercussions in Iraq. I do not want to say that I am justifying the Western intervention in the Middle East, but I think that the West should help to establish a truly independent government in Iraq. It is also important that this government wins the hearts and minds of the Iraqis. I think it is important for the West to help Iraqis achieve this, as it is also in their interest to have peace in Iraq and the whole of the Middle East, and nuclear development is not an option here.
Iran has been insisting in developing its nuclear capabilities. Samuel, how does this impact its neighbors?
Iran is playing the nuclear potential card in its attempt to become a major regional player. Some objectively argue that this was to be anticipated, since Iran is surrounded by nuclear powers like Russia, Israel, Pakistan, India and Turkey with its US bases. Hence, Iran looked for a comparable deterrent to balance the whole equation. Even Saudi Arabia has recently announced plans for weapons capabilities believed to meet the regional challenge. Actually, its facilities are reported to be at quite an advanced stage. Unsurprisingly, all Gulf Cooperation Council members had supported Iraq against Iran in the 80s. This only helps to explain why they are fretfully watching Iran's nuclear development. Of course, as U.S. regional allies, these Gulf states are caught up in an awkward juggling act. On one hand, they do not want to be seen backing another Western attack on another Muslim state, and on the other, they favor how the U.S. and the international community are pressuring Iran.
The region has been heavily affected by the Arab-Israeli conflict. Yulia, does this conflict increase the nuclear threat in the region?
Well, I am strongly convinced that conflict between Arabs and Israeli does increase the nuclear threat in the region. The thing is that today Israel is the only nuclear power in the Gulf, and if other countries will develop the same capabilities, Israel will face a greater threat from its neighbors. Israel possesses its nuclear weapons since 1960s, and some Arab scholars such as Mustafa Alani are convinced that Israel is not a threat to them, because after such a long time of having the weapons and not using them, it is very unlikely that Israel will attempt to make use of them in the future. Still, I believe that even Israel should surrender its nuclear capabilities and seek alternative means of peace assurance, although to persuade the state for such an action will not be an easy task.
International organizations have always been criticized of not enforcing international agreements and laws. Could international organizations like the UN, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and NATO have a role to curb nuclear proliferation in the region?
Decisions of international organizations are often disregarded. Undeniably, the UN tries to stop proliferations and calls for a nuclear-free zone through the UN Disarmament Conference, but this has not counted for much. A Wall Street Journal article contrasts the UN's failure and the US Proliferation Security Initiative. This ended Libyan nuclear development in 2003, and, unlike the UN, the Proliferation Security Initiative is unwavering. For the case of NATO, its expansion eastward saw the US earmarking strategic bases in the Balkans close to Turkey. There have also been suggestions of Israeli membership in NATO to pacify it. A January 2007 Sunday Times article entitled Israel Plans Nuclear Strike Against Iran disturbingly describes some sort of strike as inevitable, adding that it would be the first since 1945. U.S. weapons experts believe that even as ideal democracies, certain states would still want weapons. It is no wonder many believe a nuclear-free Middle East is in the least a political mirage. But all things considered, arms controls are a package of political processes, bargains and security guarantees, as they were in a divided Europe. Regrettably, this had more than its fair share of failure in the Middle East. Ambiguities of dual-use technologies for both civil and military purposes remain, while arms producers continue to line their pockets. All this supports realist theories in international relations. Let us only hope that as the nuclear equation balances itself, it does not cancel itself out with unspeakable results.
Thanks so much, Shikruna and Yulia Stasi, for giving us your comments and opinion in today's debate, and Bruno Parsons for research on quotes. Thanks also to Dr. Kamel Samoud and Dr. Kleda Mulai for contributing with their expertise. I hope you enjoyed today's debate. Join us for the next program today week that will discuss the impact of the environmental crisis on world politics.